Thank you all and welcome to CSIS this morning. We're very excited about this event. I'm Steve Morrison. I direct the Global Health Policy Center here at CSIS. I want to offer special thanks to Seth Gannon, Carolyn Schrote, Julia Nagel, Matt Fisher, Lindsay Hammergren for their work in pulling all of this together. We've been assisted enormously by Admiral Tom Cullison also in the preparations for this. At the Global Health Policy Center, one of our three core objectives is looking at the intersection of security and health. Along those lines, we had a very successful year-long task force focused on the DoD Overseas Medical Research Labs, which concluded its work about a year ago. General James Peake was a key personality in leading that and is going to remain very active with us in this endeavor as well. Michelle Ledgerwood was a key personality integral to all of that work. We're now looking at a follow-on project that we think makes a lot of sense, and we're going to hear about that today. Admiral Ruffhead is going to open the events today with 10 minutes of discussion around what we're trying to do and why at this particular moment. We're putting a focus upon the future of naval humanitarian engagement and medical diplomacy and what we seek to achieve in taking this on. We are also today launching later in the day a working group session. We are populating and composing a working group that will be assisting us over the course of this next 8-month, 9-month period of the work of this task force. We chose today on this occasion, the launch of this work, to ask several of our friends to come together for a lively roundtable discussion around some dimension of this so that we could take full advantage of Admiral Ruffhead being here, John Hamry, my boss, here, and the goodwill and generosity of our other friends, Admiral Middleman, Serge Duss, and Assistant Secretary Ann Richard, who have agreed to be with us. Thank you all for taking the time to be with us today. So I'm going to turn the podium over to Admiral Ruffhead to walk us through his thinking on the launch of this particular, what we feel is a very timely and compelling project, and we'll be calling upon many of you for your kind inputs and expertise as we move ahead on this. After that, he will rejoin the working group, and John Hamry will carry things forward, moderating that discussion. So thank you all for joining us. We have a number of people also online here. This is being webcast live, and the video footage will be posted on our website shortly after this. Thank you all.
I retired. It was really challenging. I've relocated out to California. I'm at Stanford University now, and I had to get a haircut. I had to buy a tie. I mean, it was just really difficult. But I was very honored when I was asked to chair this task force. As many in the audience know, partners from some of the work that we've done in the past, I see some familiar faces from my time in the Navy who worked on pulling this together. And I think it is timely to look at what I refer to as proactive humanitarian assistance. And in this instance, the medical diplomacy that's provided using the capabilities of the Navy. But I'm very, very quick to add that this is not just a Navy endeavor. It takes in the other services, the other armed services of the United States. It includes the military medical capability and technical capability of partners globally on several continents. The key component of bringing all of this together includes the non-governmental organizations, the NGOs that so generously and willingly participate in these events. So to simply look at it as a military project is really looking at it through a straw, and the aperture has to be broadened. There is no question that we are all captured when there's a humanitarian disaster, whether it's Haiti, whether it's Tomodachi, the disaster that occurred in Japan. For me, where I became involved most intimately in this undertaking was in the tsunami that swept through Southeast Asia and South Asia in 2004. I often say that it was one of the most significant professional and personal experiences of my life, in how the massive response to a truly massive disaster came together, how we did some things well, how we did some things not so well. And it was in that latter area that caused us to think about how could we better prepare, how could we bring the capability that we have within the Navy in particular to change the lives of people in less fortunate areas of the world. And that began the proactive humanitarian assistance missions that began in 2005. Since 2005, from our ships alone, we have serviced over 600,000 patients. Again, this is beyond the Navy. It is bringing that entire team together and looking at how do you do it better. And I would submit that whether it's in the Pacific, in the Western Hemisphere, or in Africa, every year we learn. Every year we become better partners among ourselves because each mission is different, and every year we progress. And so as we've now been doing that for about 7 years with our hospital ships, the Comfort and Mercy, and Mercy is out on mission now, and I think Mike's going to talk about that. And quite frankly, those are the iconic humanitarian assistance images, the hospital ship, the young babies, the international team that's taking care of those families, and particularly the children. But the other component of what we do in the times when we're not using the hospital ship is for the Navy to reach into its inventory of capability and use large amphibious ships to go in and perform not just the medical missions, but quite frankly, broader improvements to the local communities, because they can bring in engineers, they can bring in heavy construction equipment, well digging equipment, things like that. So there's a whole set of capabilities and resources that are used. The process for doing this, as I said, we learn every year how to do it a bit better, is really quite complex. I have done pure military operations, and I have done humanitarian assistance operations, both disaster response and proactive humanitarian assistance. And I will tell you, the most difficult in planning and execution is proactive humanitarian assistance, because of how you have to interact with the various groups, the lead time that you have to prepare medically, to prepare operationally, to prepare logistically. It is quite complex. And so the idea of taking a complete look at how we do this, I think, is extraordinarily timely. I'm a great fan of Winston Churchill, and he once said that however beautiful the strategy, you should occasionally check the results. And so I think this is a good opportunity for us as a community of individuals who are really concerned about how we can improve the lot of people around the world. How have we done? And then how can we do it better? And also, the great question is, in the environment in which we will be walking, fiscally and budgetarily, how is it best done if it is continued to be done? And so those are the types of questions and issues that I believe it will be good to explore. We will bring together very experienced people in this area who have been on the ground, who have had to deal with the day-to-day issues of making them work, and then also policy planners who can think more broadly about the future. And so I think it's a perfect time to do it. I think it's an important issue because, quite frankly, I believe the need is not going to diminish globally, but there will clearly be some challenges that will be faced about the ability of not just the United States to do this, but other countries upon who we rely to be able to participate in these types of activities. So the time is right, the team is right, and I thank John Hamry and CSIS for being on point on this, and I thank all of you who are here today for your interest in the topic and your continued interest as we go forward through a series of events over the coming months that will culminate in a final report that will be issued by CSIS and the Hoover Institution. So with that,
thank you
very much.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Gary. Well, first, everybody, turn on your mics, so make sure that we're ready to go. Thank you all for coming. Delighted you're here. I, like you, probably first studied Venn diagrams when I was in the seventh grade. You remember Venn diagrams, you know, where you're given a class of things and you map them out and you see where there are overlaps and, different sets of issues, and of course where there's overlap, then there are these kind of unique qualities. That's what we're going to explore today. I think, we've got three different communities, maybe more, that have their own unique character and quality and sets of goals and aspirations. But then there is this question of where can they overlap and where is it reinforcing? And where are their constraints? Where are their boundary conditions that become defining to that overlapping subset? Our goal, of course, is to try to find ways to make that overlap larger. But then what does it take to make that overlap larger? And so that's partly what we're going to explore in this session and in this project. So I want to specifically say thank you to Admiral Ruffhead. I've had a chance to know him for 15 years, but one of the most remarkable officers that we've had, one of only two officers that's commanded both fleets in the Pacific and the Atlantic, and of course that gave him he knew all of the dangerous waters that made him one of the most successful CNOs we've had, because I think it's much more about navigating the Navy than it is navigating Washington. And of course he and Ellen are now out on much earned a new phase of their life, but thank you for being willing to do this. I'm delighted that you're with us today. He comes from, of course, he's the Deputy Surgeon General. Did an awful lot of your time in the Pacific. I think you were in the Pacific during a couple of these last big episodes.
During Tomodachi, I was in the Pacific.
Why don't you start in with that? I mean, Tomodachi, of course, was the way in which we responded when Japan had this terrible tsunami, and then the follow-on Fukushima issue. So just bring alive this kind of episode a little bit for all of us today right now. Would you please?
Okay, where do I start? It was a trifecta, of course. For us, and I was responsible for the medical response in the Pacific region, we thought we had an earthquake to deal with. Then we realized we had a tsunami to deal with, and okay, we've done that before. What we didn't do before was the radioactive environment. And so the first thing we had to confront is, first of all, what type of help was needed, and I got to tell you, the Japanese medical establishment had a great handle on this. They're very capable, and they didn't need our help medically at all. So they had teams out throughout the country, and they had a good sense of what they needed to do, and they did it. From our perspective at US PACOM, where I was serving, our responsibility was the safety of, the 68,000 American service members and their families, as well as the Americans in Japan. So what we quickly learned was that it's not just a Navy response, it's not even a tri-service response, it's a whole of government response. And so where I sat, we were dealing with things like establishing water standards on our bases. What's acceptable, what's not. And we learned quickly that there weren't any. So we worked closely with the Environmental Protection Agency in establishing water standards. We established air standards. We had to establish soil standards. We were looking at the importance of decontaminating all of the aircraft that's flying in and out of the affected region. And of course, we're most responsible for the people that are flying in and out. So we're at the same time we're monitoring them, we're trying to put together a systems approach that ensures that we're capturing all of the data, we know who's going where, when, and that we can follow it over time. What's come out of that, just to save some time here, is we've established a registry so that all 68,000 Americans who we were responsible for in DOD now are included in this registry, where we can tell the worst case scenario for potential exposure, and we can follow these people over time. So that was no small task. Once again, that was not just DOD, that was working with other agencies to ensure that we got it right, whether it be NRC, whether it be state, whether it be DARPA, and all those other interactive agencies. The lessons learned from this, there are many, but just quickly, the importance of strategic communication, the importance of getting the word out uniformly, even between the services. So I know there were several conversations between what Navy was doing and Air Force was doing and Army was doing. Everybody was trying to do the right thing, but we're doing it differently. That presented some challenges for us from a strategic communication perspective. Working with the State Department, we had to ensure that no matter what we did, we were lockstep with the embassy and very cognizant of what the host nation was doing. So consequently, water standards is the great example. The Navy wanted to put everybody on bottled water at Yokosuka. We didn't think that was a very good idea based on the fact that everything was safe. And of course, there was the optic of what do you do inside the fence versus outside the fence. So working with state, working with the scientists, and working with naval reactors, we came up with what we thought was a very good way ahead that worked well. But unless we took into consideration what was happening at the embassy, what the government of Japan was doing, and also what our own people were thinking, it really presented a challenge. Remember, at the same time we're doing all this, there was a voluntary departure going on. So we were saying, if you're an American service member, you can leave. So we were sending a lot of mixed
complex
messages.
Complex environment, yeah.
It was the right thing at the time because we just didn't know. And we erred on the side of cautious. And that was, I know sitting with Admiral Willard and Admiral Walsh and listening to the conversations, we really had only so much information. And so we were dealing with that. But from the medical perspective, we were most interested in ensuring that folks were safe and ensuring that we can track them over time so that we had good outcome data 10 to 15 years down the road.
Good. We'll come back on some of this. There were several very important things that I heard you talk about. Was one of the first things, they didn't need medical help, but they needed this logistics and this organizational structure and support. And that tends to be one of the big things when you get into an environment like that. Ann Richards, you've just been confirmed. Congratulations. I guess it's only been since April.
It's 2 months,
2 months, that's good. I think that's a record that you got through so fast, and we're delighted that you're there. I mean, normally the government isn't that responsive. Ann, of course, was with International Rescue Group and has well-known figure, leader in the community, the policy advocacy community here in Washington. We're delighted that you're in service now. Delighted. I know you're going back. You were at Peace Corps before and state before, but it's great to have you. The Secretary Clinton has been championing soft power, and of course that's probably no agenda more squarely sits in your portfolio than you are the portfolio of soft power, I would guess, for a state. How does medical fit in this, Anne? Could you just open that up for us?
Well, first off, I should probably reassign the soft power portfolio to my boss, Maria Otero, who now is in charge of all civilian security with all the human rights pieces and democracy building and counterterrorism work Dan Benjamin's doing. But I think that the piece that I'm privileged now to lead, the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration, is the key humanitarian assistance office for the State Department and a very important partner to the humanitarian pieces of the U.S. Agency for International Development. And I think it's the piece that the American public is most comfortable with when you look at all of our foreign aid programs, the piece that is intended to help save lives in a crisis, short-term crises, but also long-term protracted crises. And I think we get a lot of support within the bureaucracy to do that, and also from the Congress and from the public. The thing that I thought was important talking this morning about the different roles we all play up here was that you don't have a lot of civilians you would parachute into, civilian U.S. government bureaucrats you would parachute into any crisis. Instead, what we tend to do is to work with partners. And for the Bureau I head, Population, Refugees, and Migration, the partners are UN High Commissioner for Refugees, International Committee of the Red Cross, the International Organization for Migration. The Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance at AID that takes the lead in responding to natural disasters, such as the one you were just describing in Japan, they do send a team in, the Disaster Assistance Response Team, very quickly in to assess what's going on. And then they will negotiate and end up with a grant with a non-governmental organization partners, one or a group, and such as the one that Serge represents here, the International Medical Corps. Or as I look around the room, I see representatives from other NGOs, including my former NGO. My pal Kate Phillips Barrasso is here. I'm not allowed to have a private meeting with her because I have to recuse myself. So I just want to say hi. Hey, how you doing?
We can only do this publicly.
So the head of AFDA, Mark Bartolini, is a longtime friend of mine who also came out of the NGO world. And so his first major crisis was the tsunami and nuclear dilemma. And I know he just felt it was not what he'd signed up for, the first AFDA response to a nuclear crisis. But the thing that he brought was then this ability to reach out to other parts of the U.S. government and bring in the nuclear experts, you know, and to make sure that there was a central coordinating location for the civilian response. I think that what we tend to present from the perspective of state is not just a link in then to the humanitarian diplomacy, to the secretary being able to speak with partners, and not just the connection to AID, but this connection to the United Nations and other international organizations, where they're really putting together the international humanitarian architecture, as we call it, which I don't think is very well understood in Washington by my colleagues or by the public. They always want to see one person in charge. They want to see, you know, a very hierarchical response. And I like to think of the international humanitarian response as more like a quilt where pieces are rapidly stitched together for a broad, comprehensive approach, and less that very top-down response that you see in other organizations. The medical piece of this tends to be less about treating the individual and more trying to think in very efficient ways about saving as many lives as possible across the board. And so, for example, in a refugee crisis, some of the basic things we're doing are not particularly glamorous. You know, I don't know if you'll see Nicole Kidman or Clive Owen portraying, you know, building latrines and having clean water, you know, for large groups of people, or making sure that women have a safe place to deliver children. But we have found that this can save lots and lots of lives in a very low-tech but proven way.
I turned mine off so I wouldn't squeak at you.
So forgive me for that. Serge Das is Director of Public Policy for International Medical Corps, and been very active. We had a very interesting conversation earlier. Not had extensive ties with the military before, but did have some interesting thoughts. And of course, he represents my good friend John Howe is here, and others. This enormous army of civilians that wants to respond with great impulse when there are events and crises. And of course, Serge, you're one of the leaders. I'd love to hear your thinking on this.
Yes, thank you, John. And I want to thank you and CSIS for inviting me and International Medical Corps as a representative of the international humanitarian community that we're having this discussion at the beginning of a research study process rather than at the end. And so increasingly over the years, as the civilian nonprofit NGOs have been engaging in various locations and increasingly with the U.S. military, we used to always come in at the end, but increasingly we're coming more at the beginning. And so that really does help in the planning and the communication. I'd like to move this discussion beyond the traditional emergency humanitarian responses. I think, Gary, this project is going beyond the tsunami response, the Haiti response, to more what we in the international community, and as Anne alluded to, more that's development. And I was asked, can I offer some positive opinions of the direction that the Navy is planning to move in the Asia-Pacific area? And at this point, I can't do that because not enough is known. Much more discussion, much more research and study has to take place. But I will raise, for the purpose of this discussion, four issues, four questions that I hope the Navy would discuss, as well as other agencies in the government and the NGO community. We are civilians. We represent the best humanitarian impulses of the American population. Millions of Americans support our work. Last I heard, it was something like $30 billion are contributed to all sorts of NGOs, beyond NGOs, other groups. We work very closely with the civilian part of the U.S. government because they're civilians, we're civilians. The U.S. Agency for International Development is the lead agency for both humanitarian and development, and PRM, Population, Refugees, and Migration, does enter into that area as well. So we're most comfortable working as civilians with civilians and government. And so the first question I would ask the Navy to consider, can the Navy position itself to complement the present international development infrastructure, or the long-term development structure, rather than compete with it? Secondly, the question I would ask, can the Navy transform itself beyond one-off medical programs that are more focused on long-term, rather than responding to immediate crises, but focusing on over long-term, the underlying causes of health difficulties in many low-income countries around the world? Development is a long-term process. Some NGOs, when they plan development programs, particularly in the area of health, plan for 10, 15, 20 years. NGOs focus on strengthening health systems. We work with national partners. We work with national governments. And the key is, are we being accepted? Are we being invited to work with national governments, with local governments and local folks? And in order to be able to do that successfully, even in conflict areas, trust is the primary factor. And the way trust is gained is through the building of long-term relationships. So many countries where NGOs have worked for 20, 30, 40 years, it's because of the trust between international individuals, not just from the U.S., because most international organizations have citizens from throughout the Western world and from the developing world, and it's through relationships that programs are able to continue. Even in difficult places such as Afghanistan during conflict, NGOs continue working in development because we're protected by local communities. The third question that I'd like to raise, can the Navy and other parts of the military, as it branches out into greater medical diplomacy, can it move beyond the winning hearts and minds model? Now, we understand that as the Navy is part of the U.S. government and part of your primary purpose is to defend the country and to further U.S. interests. NGOs, civilian NGOs, that's not our primary purpose. If our work contributes to the national interest and to good diplomacy, we're happy that it takes place, but that is not our primary concern. Again, back to Afghanistan, the military engaged in a counterinsurgency effort. The purpose was to win hearts and minds, and it quite frankly really undermined the long-term development programs that NGOs were involved in, because it really blurred the lines of our international civilians there working for government purposes or for different purposes. So that's an issue that that the Navy will have to ask itself. And can the Navy adhere to standards and principles of good development that have been created and established over decades of work by international, by the UN, by international NGOs, which involves quite a bit of monitoring and evaluation? Are the programs that we're doing, are they really working? And lastly, I would say over the decades, NGOs, the UN, other international institutions have made enormous mistakes. Fortunately, we've tried to learn from them. And one of them we've learned is that unmonitored aid in the humanitarian aid and in development aid, unmonitored aid is worse than no aid at all. We've also recognized something that the medical community has known for a long time, the first principle of do no harm. And we found, particularly in the post-Cold War effort as we engaged in our work, that we neglected to plan out what are some unintended consequences of our aid after Rwanda, in Bosnia, where we came in with good intentions and had very negative responses. So lastly, I would end it by saying we have learned, and I know the Navy and the rest of the military are learning as well, that good intentions are not enough. Despite all the good that we want to do, if that's our primary reason for being involved in the lives of people from other nations who have different cultures, who may not interpret our efforts in the same way that we intend them, it always leads to unintended negative consequences, and that's something that has to be researched and studied before any initiative is done.
Great. I think we didn't really coordinate that effectively in advance, but this worked out good. These are some very useful kind of, we staked down, I think, some edges here. You know, if we go back to think about this Venn diagram, and you know, what kind of is constituting the potential space on the inside? Several things that have jumped out to me that I've heard. One is, of course, the point that Serge just brought up is his long-term engagement. You know, and of course, that's certainly what we're after. I'm speaking here, but from my old Defense Department days, I think, you know, obviously we're not interested in just the PR effects of, you know, cameramen rolling, watching guys rolling dollies off the truck. We're looking at long-term structure. So obviously there's a space there. I think also I thought that what each of you have said in some sense is that there's much more to this than just medical delivery. You know, it's a safe place for a woman to bear a child. It's, you know, it's clean drinking water. It's being able to drill a well and getting a well in an emergency condition. There's a lot more to it. There's administrative structure, logistics structure, organizational things. I mean, so obviously there's a great deal of meeting opportunity, it seems to be, in that regard. I think the question of relationships with host countries becomes quite important. Obviously, you know, the military tends to come in narrowly with the power ministries, defense, interior ministry, foreign ministries, you know. You can tend to come in with health ministries. I mean, those don't tend to be the communities that naturally align. And so there's a question about how do those get aligned to this kind of an environment. So I think there's a very interesting sets of opportunities. Again, Anne, let me then turn to you. I know that you've not had an opportunity yet to work very extensively. You've only been there for a month and a half, 2 months, to engage with the military. The one thing I would say, well, let me one last preface, which is, you know, well, there's always a taxonomy of activity. You know, we've got actions that are driven by a crisis, a tsunami, an earthquake, a hurricane, you know, genuine, urgent humanitarian need. Then we've got, you talked about long-term development, you know, and then we have humanitarian activities in insecure environments, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, places like that. Very different kinds of conditions. I think this space that we're trying to explore, there's not a lot of controversy over the, well, there probably is, but, you know, not a lot of emotional controversy over cooperating in humanitarian, urgent humanitarian circumstances. It's probably more this space of development, you know, where it's not emergency, it is a peacetime engagement, it does have to be longer term. There are lots of actors already on the ground. How do we plug in? Can we kind of explore that space, and maybe to pick up where Serge left off, and I'll ask Anne to comment on it, this question of what is this long-term engagement and the full range of the government? How do you think about that? You mentioned partners, but the partners you mentioned were international partners and NGO partners. How about government partners? Can I ask you just to think a little bit out loud on this with us, and then I'd like to come back to Serge on
it. I would say the least controversial aspects of civilian and military joint responses overseas are on the natural disasters and where the military is bringing unique capabilities that nobody else can bring. And that often turns out to be questions of scale and speed, where the military can just move faster, farther, and with more than anybody else. But in many crisis situations, especially things that go on for a while, you know, there are civilian lift capabilities that can be contracted that in the long run are going to be cheaper and that are a normal part of a response. One of the tricky things, and I think this is sometimes where state is at a crossroads, is when there's the most efficient thing to do to respond, and then there's a desire on the part of political actors to show allies that we care. And so we want something that's very high visibility, and we want something that is dramatic and clearly labeled or branded a U.S. response. And so often these things, you have then a tension there between what is, you know, given the, and John, I know from your background before you were deputy secretary, you were comptroller, so you remember all these resource issues. If you're trying to work on a global dimension with limited pots of money through partners in a very cost-effective way, there's one approach. But if you're trying to do something really attention-grabbing and highly visible and with political importance, then all of a sudden that requires a very different, high-profile response. And then if you try, but that type of response can bankrupt the little pots of money I'm talking about that can do so much good around the world in some of the less, in some of the neglected places. You know, one little story I was thinking of coming this morning was the response to the Boxing Day tsunami that you were talking about, Admiral Roughhead, because when I was working for the International Rescue Committee at the time, and our folks were already on the ground because of the tensions around Aceh, where there were tensions between rebel groups and the Indonesian military there. And then the tsunami came, and all of that had to be laid aside, but our people were on the ground. So then I heard, and so they immediately started working on the response, as did everybody. And I heard that Jim Colby was going to be taking a visit, and he was at the time the very powerful appropriations chairman of the Foreign Operations Appropriations Subcommittee. So he was the key guy on U.S. foreign aid. So I called our folks and I said, you have got to meet him. You have got to stake out his hotel wherever he's staying. You have got to attach yourself to his ankles and explain to him the important role you're playing. And of course, as Serge has explained, our staff are not always Americans. You know, so I'm talking to a Norwegian guy who's got an Indonesian assistant about how important Jim Colby is. And they're thinking, you know, let's look, there's 535 members of Congress, why this guy? You know, and there's lots of governments in the world, why this guy? So meanwhile, I'm convincing them, and word comes back. And we can't get to Colby because he's not staying in a hotel. He's being helicoptered out to the USS Abraham Lincoln, where he's spending the night on board ship, you know, for his safety. And I'm thinking, oh, no, you know, once again, the Defense Department's budget will be on display to this key cardinal of the Appropriations Committee, but he's not going to see this important piece that is organized on a shoestring budget. So I think that, you know, I come back to my point about the importance, and hopefully through your working group, of an understanding of the different roles that are being played, so that we can inform each other, so we can make a combined description of all the pieces and how they ought to fit together in the most efficient way.
You know, it's inappropriate for me because I'm supposed to be just moderating, but you've opened up an experience I lived when I was a comptroller. And I think there is an impression that some people have that we in DOD are just dying to get in and spend money on natural disasters. I mean, that's not the case. You know, I'll just tell you, it is crowbarring smallest amounts of money to try to bring it together, because the last thing we want to do is to do it. We do have, there is what's called drawdown authority. There's no money there. It simply is my carving $10 million out of Gary's budget to pay for a humanitarian disaster. There's no budget set aside for it. So it's not that we're craving to, you know, jump in. Matter of fact, most of the time we're trying to find alternatives. It is, as you say, you know, the people in the White House say, I want something dramatic. I remember when we had the hurricane that came into Venezuela. It says, you're going to send ships down there, we're going to offload the stuff. And I said, look, I mean, there have got to be construction people in Venezuela that can do this a hell of a lot cheaper to open up this road than an amphibious ship offloading, you know, CB gear. I mean, but it is, as you say, this imperative. And we're not the ones craving to spend money and divert our resources for it, but there frequently aren't the right authorities that make it available to get it. So this is something we really should explore. Serge, can I come back to, you talked about, you know, international standards that prevail, that have developed over time, you know, with the development community. One of the things I've noticed is a real impediment to the civilians and the military working together is a lack of shared vocabulary. You know, the military, we tend to operate on doctrine, you know, I mean, pre-established rules on how we're going to behave, because you got to know what the next battalion's going to do, you know, with a few simple words, and you have to know exactly how he's understanding his task and what he's doing. So we operate on doctrine. And of course, all that stuff scares the hell out of civilians. It sounds very ominous. And so, but yet you have well-established standards, which really is another form of doctrine. How do we break down this barrier so that we really can talk more effectively to each other?
That's true. We do have our own doctrine and our standards, something that's been developed over many, many years, the SPHERE standards, that any international NGO that is involved in any kind of humanitarian, particularly, or development work, subscribes to standards so that we do no harm. One of our problems is, particularly during a humanitarian crisis, little groups that pop up who have no idea what the standards are, and they go, say, to Haiti and make things worse. We don't want to make things worse. The fact that we do not have a common language, the other difficulty that we face and that the Navy faces and the military faces working with NGOs is, whereas you have command and control, hierarchical, NGOs are not hierarchical. We do our best to hold in our independence as organizations to work together. And we have agreed over decades to we work with our funding partners, whether it's the U.S. government or the Norwegians or DFID in the U.K., as well as U.N., UNICEF or the U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees. So we have learned that it's in our best interest to communicate. And there are a number of years ago, there were clusters that were set up. So in a humanitarian crisis, and even beyond, there's a water sanitation cluster. There's a protection cluster. There is other types of clusters. So NGOs send their people to those groups as a way to communicate. I think as the Navy plans and decides what role it should play in development, particularly in the Asia Pacific, it will be critical for the Navy and the U.S. government, particularly the Agency for International Development, and NGOs to have these discussions to come up with a common language. Because if we don't have a common language, we will be talking past each other, and what you understand as one meaning, we will understand as another. Beyond that, then there is the national culture, the host country, who often have no idea what we're talking about, which another common language has to be developed, and an understanding particularly to employ programs, not what we want, but what do those folks want? And what kind of technical assistance can we provide that will together lead to a common good for the host population and allow us and the people who support us, citizens as well as government, to achieve those ends over a period of time. So we know that if it's done quickly, it's like building house on a sand. Mm-hmm. If you want the results to last, it has to have a good foundation, good relationships built through trust over a period of time.
Gary, let me ask you to respond to this, and then maybe you
might. It's going to sound like the two non-government guys are going to gang up on the government people here. But I couldn't agree more with a lot that Serge has said based on my experiences, and I'll touch on a couple of things. One of the greatest takeaways over the past few years for me as I was working on this is the common lexicon, the understanding of one another's doctrine, brought home very forcefully for me actually during the tsunami when we were in a planning meeting and we had all these great ideas that were generating, and there was a voice in the back of the room because we basically declassified the headquarters so that the NGOs and USAID could move freely within the headquarters to get a better sense of the flow of things. And there was a quiet voice in the back of the room that said, that's really a stupid thing to do. And we all kind of turned around, and it was someone not from the military, but who was intimately involved with NGOs, who said, this is how the NGOs are going to be looking at the problem, and this is how they're going to be responding. And so I think there's the potential there to fuse these different perspectives together, and I hope that our work, our project, is able to get that on the table. And to, my intent is not to come up with a dictionary that helps us define it, but rather a melding of the minds on how do we do this better. I think that there are also some things that I know are frustrating to the NGO community, which are U.S. government policies and constraints on how we can support non-governmental activities. I believe that there is some opportunity to have a thoughtful, unemotional discussion about what sort of policy recommendations can we put forth that will allow and will grease the mechanisms that exist in order to be more cooperative. So I think that there are some internal areas within the U.S. government that that can be examined, and quite frankly, I think that there's some potential for change that can make the response and this more protracted activity good. And then the other thing that is important, and whenever we do anything like this, and I think it's probably the same for some of the non-governmental organizations, you're always being asked, is it worth it? After the first proactive mercy mission, I received a phone call from Washington, and someone said, was it worth the money you put toward this? I was commanding out in the Pacific at the time. and for whatever reason, I was not in a very good mood. Although that's hard to not
hard
be
to
a
imagine.
Good mood out in Hawaii.
Yeah.
But, and I said, I'll tell you what, call me back in 25 years and I'll tell you. And so the question then will become, how do you take something that is a very protracted endeavor that does not, at least heretofore, lent itself well to measuring effectiveness of should it be a government team that goes in or not a government team that goes in, and how do we try to get our arms around that so that we can make decisions on what's the best mix and how do we go forward? And to a point, John, that you made, I think it's also important that we are naturally good people. We like to help. I think, as you pointed out, the vast contributions that are made by the American people to humanitarian assistance. But at the same time, we have to be very mindful of countries in which we do the proactive work to not threaten and displace that government and the importance for that government to appear to their people that they are taking care of mm-hmm. the people. And so how do you get the right models in place to do that? And those are the sorts of things that I believe this sort of discussion and work that we're going to do collaboratively can pull together.
Can we get right into that? I think that's a very interesting question, because I think each of you in some different way has talked about, you know, the impact of outside intervention has on local capacity and not wanting that to be an aim. But, and everyone has basically said in the same way it's got to be a goal, and yet I sense that there's at least different perceptions on it. Anne, did you want to start with that?
Yeah, it's very interesting to me right now that Raj Shah, the administrator of USAID, is really pushing on his folks the term resilience, that what we're trying to strive for in all of our work overseas, whether it's humanitarian peace or this very tricky relief to development piece, which the civilian side is not at all perfected, is that we should not be just doing a one-time response or trying to, you know, impose everything on a country from the outside, but instead we should be helping countries develop their own resilience. And now, in the disaster response world, it's been called disaster risk reduction. And I think this is a sort of more common English, easy for the public to understand concept. And so I think the challenge for the civilian side here then is at some point we have to stop seeing this as sending northern or western or well-educated, you know, U.S. college graduates, the folks who are all our nieces and nephews who want to work in this field, into these situations and making that the primary way of responding. But instead, we should already have worked with society so that they can organize themselves to respond to the unanticipated. And I think this is where the folks who work on disaster response domestically in the U.S. and the folks who work internationally come to agreement that this is really the wave of the future.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. Resilience. That is, even though we've thought about and have done in some ways resilience as we respond to the day after the humanitarian response, that is being incorporated across the board, across the international community, in how do we do our work so that the next disaster that takes place, the damage is not as severe. Let me take the case of Pakistan. The relations between Pakistan and the U.S. are at a pretty low. We had this case of a bogus vaccination program, which has pretty much devastated international NGO work in Pakistan because of the involvement of the CIA. This is all well known. Be that as it may, the Pakistan government, which is really hostile toward international NGO presence, from what I'm told, is very open to working with the international sector on disaster risk reduction and resilience. It recognizes the constant regularity of flooding and other disasters that takes place, and at the highest levels of government realizes that it needs to create something to lessen the damage of natural disasters. So here's an area that it is looking for technical assistance and partnership with governments and international and particularly local communities to build themselves better so that the damage is less from the cyclones, heavy rains, flooding that comes afterwards. So this is a very good piece. And if I could, John, make a mention to Mike as the Deputy Surgeon General. I think the challenge for the Navy, which has, I've been in discussions with Navy folks at in Rhode Island and Virginia, come to recognize the great capacity, the knowledge of Navy medicine, second to none. As you begin this study of what's the Navy's role in development in Asia Pacific, to be able to find, okay, where's the place that the Navy, with all of its resources, lessening resources, can contribute to the ongoing development work that's taking place in specific countries? Probably won't be able to do it in every country, but in specific countries that it could make life better and contribute to the stability of local societies and strengthening of local societies that will contribute to better life for all.
If I can respond, a couple of points. First of all, so what you said resonates 100% with us in Navy medicine. It's all about building capacity and capability. It's not about going forward and doing the med caps. We learned, I think, the hard way, many times, unfortunately, that when you do that, you undermine a health system, you undermine a government oftentimes, and frankly, we don't know what else we undermine when we do these kinds of things. To your point, let me talk about first Pacific Partnership. One of the missions of Pacific Partnership is to build resiliency and to build relationships in the Pacific, but it's basically, you know, it was born out of the tsunami in 2004, but the whole idea behind that is to how do we better prepare these smaller nations to prepare themselves to respond to some sort of a contingency emergency type of situation. Initially, you know, we didn't quite figure it out. We thought we'll go there and we'll just show the flag, we'll do a bunch of surgeries, and you know, everybody feels good about Americans. As we all know here, that's not the answer. So we regrouped a couple of times, and frankly, it wasn't with a Mercy mission, it was with a Greyhull mission, that we were able to go ashore and start building healthcare system capacity and capability. We'll send a biomedical technician into one of these smaller communities and teach their technicians how to fix their x-ray machine. Don't try to give them a CAT scanner. Do things like that. But at the same time all this is going on, Navy medicine, and frankly with the other services as well, has been doing other things in other countries. And I'll use our research labs as a perfect example of this, you know, to what you just mentioned. You know, how do we make lives better and affect the host nation? Our NAMRU 2 is in Cambodia and Laos right now, working on dengue and malaria. But we're doing it very quietly, and we're integrated in with their Ministry of Health, say, in Cambodia, so that we're a force multiplier for them doing infectious disease research and also doing disease surveillance. So that positively affects the Cambodian people, but it also positively affects us. In Laos, we're doing very similar things. We're also obviously administering the PEPFAR program and DHAP through NAMRU and other entities. But what Ambassador Stewart tells me in Laos is that through medical diplomacy, that's often her only way to access the Ministry of Defense in Laos. They only want to talk medicine. And so that gives us a lot of insight and also interoperability between the Ministry of Defense as well as Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Ministry of Health. So all of these things are happening. And it's not done in a vacuum. It's done in response to, frankly, the U.S. Pacific Command and State Department's theater campaign plan. So, you know, we talk about Navy influencing life in the Pacific and medical engagement, but we have to remember that we're a tool that, in this case, Admiral Locklear is using to further U.S. strategy and to build stability in the region. Now, we in Navy medicine have clearly realized the importance of partnering with the interagency USAID and also the NGOs. We just hosted an NGO conference about a month and a half ago where we came up with some key issues that we need to address, first of all being communication. You talk about different languages. We talk different languages amongst our services, so it's even more of a challenge working with the NGOs. But the language of medicine is very succinct and very much the same. And it's all about doing the right thing and doing, you know, doing good. The problem is everybody's vision of doing good is different. You get a maxillofacial surgeon, they're going to want to go out and they want to do surgery. I'm an optometrist, I want to go do glasses. When we first got the measures of performance from a lot of our missions, we used to see, you mentioned 600,000 patient contacts. I sat at my desk and go, that's great, but what did we do? I don't care if we just dispense 500,000 pair of glasses. What we need is a measure of effectiveness to determine exactly how did we influence the community that we're trying to respectively influence. And I would argue that our measures of effectiveness might be a little different. We may be coming at this a little bit differently. We're trying to assure that couple of things. One, we're building resiliency of the nations, but two, we're trying to influence them in the sense that we can maintain the stability of the Asian Pacific area, whether it be through access, whether it be through communication and other areas. Mm-hmm. I would say that we can partner and should be partnering and enabling us to do this. The NGOs have been in many of these countries a lot longer than we. So you understand the intricacies of the host nation. You understand how to interact. What we can bring is we can bring the logistics, we can bring the subject matter expertise exchanges, and we can bring, frankly, a quick response if necessary. So I think it's extremely complex, as everybody, I think, here recognizes. But I don't want you to get the impression that the Navy's been off doing our thing and, we're cowboys at this. Frankly, I think we've evolved in such a manner that we realize it's a team sport. We recognize the complexities of it, and frankly, because of this new fiscal world we're moving into, we realize we can't do it ourselves. So we need to be partnering very much with NGOs and others to ensure that we get it right.
Gary, did you want to jump in?
I think Mike touched on something that really is at the crux of the issue. I think we really focus almost exclusively or too much on measures of performance, and we need to get to measures of effectiveness. In other words, the eyeglasses that are given to a young kid, is that kid now able to read a book and attend school? You know, to me, that's a measure of effectiveness. We handed out a pair of glasses, measure of performance. Have we seen changes in the schools on Holo Island? Are there more kids there wearing glasses who can now get into their subjects? That's just one example, but I think we really need to take a look at that. And the other thing that I would say is as we go through this project. It will be important, I believe, to keep in mind that the resources, at least in the case of the Navy and the military, that we use for these missions are not exclusively for these missions. That the amphibious ships that are used to go out and be on the Africa Partnership Station, for example, which is an extraordinary way to bring people together. Short anecdote. There was a meeting off the coast of Africa, one of the countries where we were, and there were various government agencies and departments from this country. And they looked at one of our officers and said, this is the first time we've ever been in the same room together on a U.S. Navy ship. So there, that's how we bring it together. But we have to keep in mind that there are other uses for the resources that we're using. The key will be, how do we optimize and what's the right mix? And how do we know that we are participating in a way that is complementary to and actually additive to what other elements of the U.S. government are doing, the NGO community is doing, and our foreign partners are doing? And I think if we can move further down the road in that regard, then I believe that this would be a very helpful and worthwhile product.
I apologize. I've let I've let this go on too long without turning to questions, and we're going to turn to questions. But I did want to say thank you. I thought it was a fascinating cut of insights. Start over here, Sydney. Yeah. Can we get a microphone down here, right up in front, and most of a lot of the questions, and just wait because we want to make sure we get it recorded.
Thank you, sir. Sydney Friedberg, AOL Defense. Let me ask, being a journalist, I'm going to ask the cynical questions now. Let me ask the Defense Department side folks, you know, what's in it for us in the context of, this is the question you were asked on the phone, Admiral, I know, you know, was it worth the money? In the context of the new Defense Strategic Guidance, with its emphasis on low cost, low footprint, long-term building partnership capacity, this seems to have some natural affinity for that. But, you know, try to articulate, in the context of that strategy, what's in it for us? And for the civilian folks, well, you, ma'am, were on both sides of the Venn diagram on this, but for the civilian folks, you know, you mentioned touching this briefly, you know, the military's value added perhaps is greatest in the logistics, in the surge capacity. You know, we've talked a lot about development here, but is the military's real core competency long value added in the long-term development, or is that where the military, you know, can be, as we saw in Pakistan, sometimes more of a liability than a help?
Okay, you want to just respond to the first question, which is this, does this make sense for us to do this?
You know, everyone's a function of their perspective. And the, you know, as I have looked at this and as I have been party to it, the fact that we are going in and dramatically with NGO partners and other U.S. government agencies, foreign partners, changing the lives of people in a way that that caused them to perhaps have a more benign outlook on life, I think, is a positive. And I'll go to an example on Holo Island. Years ago, there was a ship called SS Hope. We are now in Holo Island with Mercy, years later, decades later, in fact. And an elderly gentleman came in with a framed picture of Hope. And he showed it to the doctors that were taking care of someone in his family. And he said, "We've never forgotten this." And so, you know, I would submit that that has changed someone's view of the world and someone's view of are there good people, and from good people do good things come. And so you do that. You go in and you train a class of nurses in new techniques, or as Mike mentioned, you teach someone how to fix x-ray machines. And I would submit that you're changing the fabric of communities in a very positive way. And I think that there's value in that. There's great value in that.
And maybe the Laotian MOD will talk to you when it didn't before, too.
Okay, Anne, did you want to respond to?
You know, the interesting thing I thought in Pakistan was that, there's a lot of interesting things in Pakistan, but one thing was that I noticed that the American government officials, DOD, state, AID, in turning to disaster response in Pakistan after flooding and earthquakes, would go to lead military people in Pakistan. And why was that? It was because they were the most organized in responding to crises inside Pakistan. So I think we are perhaps partly to blame in not having invested in developing civilian disaster response capabilities in Pakistan. So, you know, I would try to argue with people we should really be trying to, on some of these natural disasters in Pakistan, make sure that we're dealing with civilians and not always the military. And they'd say, well, the military's the only group that can do this. So this, I think, shows you where going forward, we don't want to have to, in talking to another country about natural disaster response, only call on their militaries. You know, we don't want to do that in the United States. We want to have private sector, municipal governments, everybody organized to respond better to any kind of threat in the U.S. And so we should export that model as well.
Mm-hmm. in answer to your question about the Navy value added and development, I think we need to explore that. We don't know exactly what it is. And I think this project, I hope this project will do that, to be able to document where has there been a Navy value added in development, not in emergency response, but in development, and identify it and see what kind of value and can it be replicated.
Back here? Yeah, yes, ma'am.
Hi, Nancy Harris from JSI. I am going to follow on the value added of the Navy, and one of the things that surprises me is that we all seem to be in the present, and one of the potential that no one has talked about is the incredible capability of the military to do long-term planning and forecasting. And given the potential of rising sea levels and what that will mean for development, for health, for I'm surprised it has not come into the discussion, because that would seem to be a place where there was a natural partnership to help everybody kind of forecast what's coming in the next 20 years.
Did you, either one of you?
Yeah, I'm sensitive to this because I'm working another project with another think tank on exactly that. So I'll.
There's another think tank?
But I think it does fit in, because as we look at countries where there could be need for assistance, you know, I always look at two things as in my murky crystal ball. One being demographics, the other economies. And if you're faced with sea level rise or changes in fishing stocks and things like that, those two elements portend places where maybe you can render some assistance. And so as I think as we look at a long term, you know, we don't want to go piling in when there's a lot of other activity. But perhaps we can say, you know, we believe that because of demographic changes, economic changes, that this is a country that's going to need this particular type of support. I think that can be part of this planning process and drawing others into it, because, you know, we have one perspective. Other people have a different perspective, and I think the richness of bringing that together could be very beneficial.
Mitzi, we'll take it down here.
I'm Mitzi Wertheim with the Naval Postgraduate School, and I went and from the Peace Corps to the War Corps, as I call it. it was the best thing that ever happened to me, getting to the Pentagon, so I have to thank you all. I'm really interested in the issue of process. This is all about process, and process is not something that's taught, perhaps in business schools, but nowhere else. And my question is, how do you capture this knowledge so it's available for the next folks that are coming along? How do you share it? And finally, how do you deal with the problem that we have a nation that prefers firefighters than fire preventers? And so it's a question of how you tell your stories, your narrative, so the general public understands why what you're doing is so important and so valuable. And thank you for an absolutely extraordinary meeting. Thanks, John.
Thank you. We've had two people talk about lessons learned. Sarah, you talked about lessons learned from the international community. I know you guys do doctrinal lessons learned all the time. Why don't you each just take a word?
Well, I would say, as we do process, we don't want to, as a Presbyterian, we're all about process, and sometimes it doesn't lead anywhere.
And you all know the answer.
That's right. I would say in this case, we have to decide, as we engage in a process, what are our competing interests? There is the national interest, which the Navy and the military, which is primary. For NGOs, we have the national interest that is ignited by the civilians, the American public, who supports us. The government's civilians, but it has to be cognizant of all the various interests. I would say we have to decide what our interests are and how do we reconcile them so that what our mission and vision as civilian NGOs, we're able to achieve that. The military, what its vision and interests are, as a tool of the U.S. government? What does it want to achieve? And how do we sublimate some of that so that we can do more together than we would accomplish each by ourselves?
Yeah, I'll add on to that. I mean, we when we're looking at these missions, we take a great deal of time planning and looking back at lessons learned. So what do we collect from last time so that we can do this better? My soapbox is I don't think they're lessons learned, by the way, until you change behavior.
Right.
So they're merely observations. I think we're doing a lot better, especially with the humanitarian assistance missions, in learning some of the lessons, just by the mere fact that we've engaged the NGO community as not just come be a guest, but be a partner. And that took us a while to learn that lesson, but we're learning it, and we're moving forward with that. It's bigger than that, though. It's working with the interagency. You know, we're all on the same team, you would think, but it's very difficult melding together state, USAID, Public Health Service, and those entities as we work through this process. And we all have different processes, which makes it a bit more of a challenge. But we're muddling through that. I think this think tank will help if we can establish some rules and establish some lines of communication. That's what I'm excited about.
Yes, ma'am. Right over here. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Yep. Second row. I'll come back. We'll move back.
Hi, my name's Marguerite Papuano. I'm with the Development Alternatives Incorporated, DAI. And a very important, I've worked at CDC and am a veterinarian by training, so whenever I've come to think about planning, preparedness, and response, the notion of multi-sectoral cooperation, not only as we've been talking about DOD and civilians, but also the importance of health, agriculture, environment, which was also raised, ministries of transportation, and I think there's a huge opportunity here as the task force commences its work to really think about the full panoply of sectors, departments that are so critical to response, but hopefully putting into place plans, practicing them to change behaviors and to get countries ready. I guess it's more of a comment, but maybe a response, the thinking. And clearly, where ministries of defense and DOD, this would be a wonderful opportunity, I think, to really weave in where on within host countries the their role as the work of the Navy and DOD looks to the future on this. Thank you.
Yeah, you want to just kind of collect it?
Just a quick comment on that. You know, none of our missions that we're executing, especially with Mercy or the Grey Hulls, are done in a vacuum. So the host nation actually invites us there. They participate in the planning, and they tell us what their requirements are. In this mission in particular, we've got veterinarians and others engaged so we can look at the zoonotic diseases, but also help with the agricultural sector. So that's been part of our evolution as we move forward with that. So it's a great point that you make. Thanks.
Okay, we'll do one last question here before we have to wrap up. Thank you.
Admiral Ruffhead, George Nicholson from Strathcorp. Good to see you again, sir.
Good to see you.
A question a lot of people may not realize, what you did with the maritime strategy, where humanitarian assistance and disaster relief used to be a collateral responsibility, and you escalated it to a core capability. Do you see a role to have something in the future, like we have a COMPLAN 0300 for SOCOM? Do you see something like a COMPLAN for disaster relief and humanitarian assistance where other agencies can be tapped to provide resources?
I think that in the case of disaster response, the individual regional areas will work that. I really believe that the way forward is not to have a con plan per se, but rather a more fluid organization. This is for the proactive piece on how the contributions can be made, because I think there are just so many variables. I believe that the resources that the various elements will have will be more fluid, and so the term con plan in my mind is a very black and white type of approach. I believe that if we can come out of this with a framing structure that helps us evolve the process, more flexibility may be better than a cookbook that oftentimes con plans can be.
You know, this was a far better session than I had thought it was going to be, because it gave us real content to think about as we move forward. I want to say thank you to everybody.
Can
for
we make a few?
Absolutely, Anne. Why don't you start? Yeah.
Well, in critiquing my own contributions today, I think I left out a couple of important points. One was I tended to talk more about natural disasters than the more complex conflicts that my own bureau works in. I probably did that on purpose, because it's less controversial. It's easier to work in it. But it's tougher when the bullets are flying. And so that's it's for your next roundtable like this. We could take it to, you know, the 2.0 version of this. We'd have to look at, you know, these more dangerous places in which we work. Also, I think the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migrations, we always talk about providing aid, but we also talk about providing protection to people. And by that, we don't just mean trying to enhance people's physical security. We don't provide it directly, but we try to enhance it, but also to preserve people's rights and to ensure that they are, that any kind of aid, as Serge was saying, do no harm, any kind of aid distribution, for example, you don't find elderly people trampled underfoot or women attacked on the way home. So this protection piece of it is, I think, less well understood than this, the basic aid piece. And then also Mitzi was talking about trying to do a better job informing each other. I think one of the challenges to that is these communities in which we work, the uniformed military or the foreign service diplomats, the NGO folks, they all turn over every couple of years. And so that makes it much harder to try to pull together a group of people who can work well together and prepare to do that. And, you know, I've been influenced in conversations with you and with others that, you know, perhaps some of these tools of the internet and of videos that you can download from any place on Earth, you know, these kind of educational tools should be really used more. You know, Diplopedia, for example, the State Department's version of Wikipedia, that we have a lot of the basics already on there, so that if someone finds themselves in a situation where they're much is being expected to them and they don't feel they completely are ready to interact with other agencies and with NGOs and or the UN agencies, that they have a source to go to that they can at least start to inform themselves about this.
Serge, did you want any wrap-up comments?
I would, and I would go back to the very beginning, a comment that I made, that the U.S. Agency for International Development is the lead agency for the U.S. government on issues of humanitarian, but particularly development assistance, not PRM, not to be forgotten. And I think NGOs, civilian NGOs, are much more comfortable having conversations and planning with the civilian part of the U.S. government. I think it would be to the advantage of the Navy and every other service of the U.S. military that engages in what you've been discussing, is let us have this conversation under the auspices of the lead civilian U.S. government agency. I think it would smooth over some rough spots. It would allow us to feel a lot more comfortable as we have this discussion. Plus, the Navy has to coordinate with this part of the government anyway, so why couldn't we do it together?
And Mike?
Just a couple things. You know, we view Navy medicine as a strategic enabler for the nation, whether it be carrying out what we do in Afghanistan and Iraq with the Marines, or whether it be doing humanitarian assistance, disaster relief in the Pacific or in Pakistan, wherever it's needed. We clearly recognize the importance of partnering. You know, we've got health affairs attachés and embassies in Vietnam, Papua New Guinea, working the whole of government approach. So we understand that it's not a pickup game. It is very much a team approach. And so what we want to be is we want to be the tools that can get out the gate, that can help assure that the mission gets accomplished, and that we can be the extender for, frankly, you know, a lot of the other entities. We view ourselves as oftentimes the folks that can help, you know, get the fire started, But the sustainment and keeping the fire going probably should be coming through NGOs and state and other entities that really have that sustainment mission.
And finally,
sure. Well, I think from the discussions up here, it's very clear that it's a very broad area of interest and quite frankly, of increasing cooperation that we've seen over the years. The purpose of what we're about ready to undertake is to look at where we've been, where we can go, where we will be able to go, because we are all, I think, not just within the U.S. government, but other governments and other agencies and NGOs are potentially going to feel pinches that we have not felt in the past. And this is a good point in time to take a look at that and look to the future and see how we can knit this together in a way that, quite frankly, has always motivated me, and that's to make a difference in people's lives wherever they may happen to be, because at the end of the day, I truly do believe that when people have had the experience of good things happening to them, they tend to return the favor. And if that's too lofty a goal, so be it, but I think it's a worthwhile endeavor to undertake, and I look forward to working with the groups within the U.S. government, within the military, NGOs, state, and other agencies that have been pointed out that I think can bring something unique and special to the endeavor, and we'll keep you posted as we go forward.
I'd like to say thank you to you, Admiral Ruffhead, for being willing to do this. This grew out of a conversation that we had about some genuine concern that as this budget starts to really tighten up, we'd first start off by saying they're going to retire the Comfort and the Mercy and saying, you know, we're going to lose those ships. And then we're going to lose, you know, we're going to lose amphib ships. We're going to lose training dollars that are currently being used for medical outreach. I mean, you know, all of it, you know, there's kind of a mistaken view that somehow these dollars are taking money away from AID. They're not. These dollars will never go to AID if they disappear from DOD. And they are very much at risk of being lost. And that's really what kind of got us started saying, there's an important message we've got to do. Can we expand this Venn diagram in a way so that it becomes a benefit to, you know, everyone? And that's going to be what we'll try to explore together. Would you all please say thank you to our panelists for this very, very interesting.
Thank you.
That's fun, huh?
Yeah.
Thanks for inviting us. Yeah.